From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Business leaders and politicians in New Orleans are talking openly of wanting to change the demographics of the city, and they brought in private paramilitary security firms that have operated with impunity in Iraq. What we're seeing now out of the rubble of New Orleans is a new model for crisis profiteering, corporations, and private security.
The real looting begins, the privatization of a city and the paramilitary forces being brought in to protect it. We'll speak with Jeremy Scahill and Naomi Klein. And we'll take a look at the anti-war protests scheduled in Washington, D.C. this weekend with the head of United for Peace and Justice. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. It is now estimated some 2.5 million people are in the process of fleeing their homes in the Gulf Coast region of the United States as Hurricane Rita careens toward the country. Already, rains and heavy winds are being felt in Louisiana and parts of Texas. The storm is scheduled to hit sometime Saturday. On Thursday, the storm weakened slightly from Category 5 to 4 status, but meteorologists warned it could pick back up before hitting the U.S. The freeways out of Houston remain jam-packed with vehicles full of people attempting to leave the city, and the Texas National Guard dispatching tanker trucks to help motorists who've run out of gas. Unfortunately, some reports that the nozzles of their tankers are not able to be put into the cars. Meanwhile, there are fears in New Orleans that the city's fragile levees could break from the impact of Rita. In a major address delivered at the Pentagon Thursday, President Bush said clearly U.S. forces would not withdraw from Iraq, quote, on my watch, saying that would give terrorists the chance to, quote, claim an historic victory over the United States. Bush also attacked the growing chorus of people in the U.S. and across the world calling for the U.S. to withdraw from Iraq.
Position is wrong. Withdrawing our troops would make the world more dangerous and make America less safe. To leave Iraq now would be to repeat the costly mistakes of the past that led to the attacks of September the 11th, 2001.
President Bush's speech comes just days ahead of what's expected to be one of the largest anti-war protests in U.S. history. It's planned for Saturday. As he spoke, a new CNN USA Today Gallup poll was released showing 55% of Americans believe the U.S. should speed up withdrawal plans, while only 21% say the United States definitely would win the war in Iraq, while more than a third of the people say they considered the war unwinnable. In his address, the president also publicly acknowledged more than 1,900 U.S. soldiers have been killed in Iraq, and he said some 18,000 U.S. troops serving in Afghanistan have not yet finished their mission. The Senate Judiciary Committee voted Thursday to approve John Roberts' nomination as the next Supreme Court Chief Justice, a move virtually assuring his confirmation by the Senate next week. The official tally was 13-5, with the committee's 10 majority Republicans lined up solidly behind the conservative judge's nomination to the full Senate weeks in advance. The five Democrats that voted against Roberts were Dianne Feinstein of California, Joe Biden of Delaware, Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts, Charles Schumer of New York, and Dick Durbin of Illinois. Both Russ Feingold and Patrick Leahy voted in favor of Roberts, stunning many in the pro-choice and civil liberties movements. A spokesperson for Senate Majority Leader Dr. Bill Frist said Thursday the Securities and Exchange Commission had contacted Frist's office about the sale in June of his shares in HCA, the giant hospital company founded by his family. The SEC contacted Frist after the Tennessean newspaper raised questions this week about the profitable timing of the sale. There's been much speculation about whether Frist engaged in insider trading. The Greyhound Bus Company, the nation's largest intercity bus company, has threatened to fire employees who sell bus tickets to undocumented immigrants. The company's so-called transportation of illegal aliens policy warns Greyhound's customer service employees to beware of people in large groups moving in single file and traveling with little or no luggage. It says other telltale signs include people, quote, trying to hide or stay out of plain view, or large groups led by a, quote, guide who holds everyone's tickets. Greyhound also says immigrant smugglers give themselves away by calling bus stations to ask if immigration authorities are present and by loitering, repeatedly buying large numbers of tickets for other people and using phrases like, these guys just crossed the line, my cargo, and I've got to move my people. The policy warns failure to comply could result in the employee's firing and possible arrest. The policy was largely unknown outside the company until La Opinion, a Spanish-language newspaper in Los Angeles, reported on it earlier this month. Iraqi officials in Basra say they're cutting off relations with the occupation forces until the British military and government apologize and provide compensation for the British attack on an Iraqi prison. This comes amid popular anti-British demonstrations in Basra, with many calling for the British to leave. Mohammed al-Ubaidi, the head of the Basra Governing Council, said that a meeting was held Thursday between the 41 members of the Basra Governing Council and British government representatives. Ubaidi said the decision to sever relations was made after that meeting. Iraqi officials say 5 Iraqi civilians were killed and 44 wounded as a result of fighting that happened because of the British raid. In Ohio, a 1998 state law that requires parental consent for girls under 18 to get an abortion was put on hold again Thursday, hours before it was to go into effect for the first time. The ACLU had sued on behalf of a Cincinnati clinic after the law was approved, effectively keeping it on hold for years while the case was in the courts. In a speech at American University on Monday, former President Jimmy Carter told an audience he was certain Al Gore won the 2000 presidential election. The website RossStory.com posted audio of the remarks.
I would say that in the year 2000, the country failed abysmally in the presidential election process. There's no doubt in my mind that Al Gore was elected president.
Former President Jimmy Carter. The ACLU has filed a federal lawsuit in Atlanta on behalf of 2 vegan protesters who they say were subjected to imprisonment, arrest, and harassment by Homeland Security. The lawsuit stems from a December 2003 incident when vegans Caitlin Childs and Christopher Freeman were protesting on public property outside a honey-baked ham store in Georgia's DeKalb County. After the protest, the 2 say they were being watched and photographed by a man in an unmarked car. They approached the car and wrote down the make, model, color, and license plate number on a piece of paper. They then noticed the unmarked car was following them. According to the ACLU suit, the car contained both a uniformed police officer and an undercover detective, later identified as Homeland Security Detective D.A. Gorman. The 2 pulled in behind Childs and Freeman and ordered them to exit their car. Gorman then demanded she turn over the piece of paper on which she had copied the license tag number. Childs refused to hand the paper over and was handcuffed. She also says she was searched by a male officer despite her request to be searched only by a female officer. And finally, Coretta Scott King has returned home after spending more than a month in the hospital after suffering a stroke and a mild heart attack. The stroke initially left the 78-year-old widow of the slain civil rights leader, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., unable to speak or move her right side. But her doctors say she has made some recovery over the past 5 weeks. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers. Well, Hurricane Rita is now just a day or so away from the U.S. coast, and more than 1.8 million people are being told to evacuate Gulf Coast communities, particularly in Texas and Louisiana. For many, it is a horrible nightmare that is about to strike for a second time. As Rita bears down on the U.S., the devastation of Katrina remains. A lot of attention has focused on the government's failures to protect the people of Louisiana, and the question that still looms over all of this: if New Orleans was New England or Florida, would this have been allowed to happen? Well, as calls increase for an independent investigation into the Bush administration's handling of the hurricane, the wealthy elite of Louisiana, politicians and corporations are moving ahead with what may best be termed an agenda of disaster profiteering.
Today, we're going to take an in-depth look at what some are calling the beginning of the real looting of New Orleans. The cover stories of this week's Nation magazine examine what has been happening behind the scenes as wealthy business leaders meet with politicians and government officials, plotting a path to rebuild New Orleans their way. Meanwhile, these same forces have brought in some of the most feared private security companies in the world to protect their interests. We're joined now by two journalists who've just returned from New Orleans. On the line from Canada is writer and author Naomi Klein. Her piece in The Nation is called Purging the Poor. And we're joined in our studio by Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill. His piece in The Nation is called Blackwater Down. Fresh from Iraq, private security forces roam the streets of an American city with impunity. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Naomi Klein, let's begin with you. Lay out this story, what you have found, Purging the Poor.
Thanks, Amy. Listening to Juan's introduction, maybe what we're seeing is an attempt to turn New Orleans into New England. It's really an extremely radical vision, and I think the context for this is there's something about natural disasters that brings out a really dangerous apocalyptic side in the national psyche or in certain people in positions of power, where there's this actual sense that these cataclysmic events are almost redemptive in their violence. And we started to hear this very early on after Katrina hit, where not just from evangelical Christian sites where you started to hear, okay, well, maybe this is punishment for Mardi Gras and the sodomites and we've cleaned the city, but you even hear it from the mayor, Ray Nagin, saying, okay, for the first time, New Orleans is free of crime and violence, and we're going to keep it that way. There's almost a sense that free of people, the city has become this blank slate. And in that context, this fantasy can be built from scratch. And the buzzwords to listen for in terms of the reconstruction of New Orleans are smaller, safer. And the idea is that that in the city, wealth really buys altitude. And so the effect of the flood was not at all democratic. The people who were able to buy land on high ground, their neighborhoods are relatively unscathed, and many of them never left or have been able to return. And the people who were hit hardest were the people who we saw on television, in the Superdome. These are the people who lived in the low-lying areas. So the idea now is, okay, well, maybe we won't rebuild those areas at all. And when on September 15th, when the mayor said that certain areas are able to be re-inhabited, this is before Rita presented itself as the threat that it is, it was clear that the people repopulating New Orleans didn't look very much like the people who lived there before. It was overwhelmingly white, whereas the people still living in shelters were overwhelmingly black. So I think that the overall vision is massive land grabs, radical gentrification, and as Jeremy's piece makes clear, the gentrification is happening with privatized military force.
Well, in your article, Naomi, you talk about the areas that have begun to be repopulated, and you mention the census figures on the racial breakdowns. The French Quarter, 90% white. The Garden District, 89% white. Audubon, 86% white. And you talk about the attempts to the housing that was vacant in these neighborhoods that is not being used to settle some of those dislocated. Could you talk about that further?
Yeah, well, I was really struck, Juan, that there's just been this general acceptance that because of this geographical quirk of New Orleans, which is that the rich and the white live on high ground and the poor live in low-lying areas, that, of course, there is going to be this massive demographic shift in the city. And there's been this acceptance that the people who were displaced to Houston and now being displaced again, that have been scattered across the country, will just keep moving because there's really nowhere for them to return to. This kind of became accepted wisdom very, very quickly. And I was doing some research about the fights over development before the hurricane, because one of the things that I've noticed in my research is these huge cataclysmic events are often opportunities for to exploit the dislocation that happens after a natural disaster to ram through a very unpopular policy. So I started researching what the battles were in New Orleans before the hurricane. And, of course, they were very various. You know, and you've covered this on the show, there were very fierce battles going on around housing projects and gentrification in the city, where conflicts between people who are demanding affordable housing and particularly the tourism sector around the French Quarter. And over the course of this research, I saw this really staggering figure, which is that the French Quarter, which, as you said, is 90% white, is also almost half empty. That's in the most recent census, and the market hasn't changed since then. The French Quarter had a 37% vacancy rate, which means that 37% of the apartments and homes in the French Quarter are sitting empty. And they're sitting empty because the people who own those buildings have decided that they'd rather board up the apartments than take reduced rent, because they're making enough off their commercial rents, renting to restaurants and bars and so on. So when I saw this massive dislocation happening and all of these people saying, well, there's nowhere for them to return to, I looked at the census again and looked at all these other areas that the mayor had said are dry and inhabitable, and found that there were comparably high vacancy rates in other areas like the Garden District and the Central Business District. And what we found was that, in fact, there are 12,000 empty apartments and houses in the dry areas, which means that those could be affordable houses for people.
And yet they argue that the authorities argue there's no infrastructure to support them, no water, no electricity, or the water is worse than that. There's water, but it's polluted.
Well, I'm not. You know, I don't think it could happen at this point tomorrow, but the mayor has said, and obviously because it's possible the city could flood again. But the context that we're talking about is that the mayor said these areas are ready to be re-inhabited by the people who lived there previously. If they're ready to be re-inhabited by the people who lived there previously, then those apartments could clearly be opened up, and it could be part of the reconstruction process rather than just scattering people. And we've heard this demand from community groups like Community Labor United demanding the right to return to the city. And this is a huge political issue related to this radical militarized gentrification agenda, because people can't fight for their economic and social rights, saying, you know, we want schools and hospitals to rebuild, we want affordable housing. They can't make those demands. They can't fight for their social interests, their economic interests, if they're not in the city, if they're scattered and living in shelters. So I think that there can be a fairly short-term plan to get people into those houses, and I've talked to some legislators who say that it's a pretty simple process of the city passing an ordinance and then federal monies being used to issue Section 8 vouchers to pay landlords 100% of the rent. And all that's lacking, Amy, is really just the political will to do it, because this doesn't fit the Bush agenda for the so-called reconstruction of New Orleans, because what that agenda is really treating the city as a laboratory for their so-called ownership society. And so rather than subsidizing rents, what they're interested in is this bizarre Urban Homesteading Act, which would auction off federal land or lottery off federal land, and people would build homes on that land.
Also, Naomi, your article talks about a document that you got a hold of that deals with some meetings that have occurred to discuss how to, I think it was the Heritage Foundation was involved, to begin to discuss how to implement some of the conservative movement's programs under the guise of dealing with the crisis of Katrina.
Yeah, there are two key documents that people should really take a look at. We're going to have them up on the Nation website, and I'm sure we can have them up on Democracy Now! As well. There's two documents. They come from the same people, and they're connected. The first one comes from the Republican Study Group, which is the caucus of Republican lawmakers in Congress, headed by Mike Pence, and it is called the Pro-Free Market Ideas for Responding to Hurricane Katrina and High Gas Prices. It comes out of a meeting that took place at the Heritage Foundation on September the 15th, where people from the Heritage Foundation and other right-wing think tanks got together with the Republican Study Group members, and they brainstormed 32 policy demands to package in as hurricane relief. And we've already seen several, and this is why I think it should be taken extremely seriously, is that the first of the demands is automatically suspend Davis-Bacon prevailing wage laws in disaster areas. So it's pretty clear that the people making this list have a very direct line to President Bush, because that's already been adopted by presidential decree. The second is make the entire affected area flat tax-free enterprise zone. This is Bush's Gulf Opportunity Zone idea, making the whole region a sort of Club Med for corporations to have every tax break they've ever dreamed of. But it goes on, and this is where we I think need to get ready. They use the excuse of Katrina to talk about everything from opening up drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge to subsidizing, and this is an incredible one of their demands. They want to subsidize oil exploration, saying that the corporations won't fund this themselves. And then there's things that we have heard about, like that they don't want money to be going directly to public schools for displaced children who are affected by the hurricane. They want it to go into school vouchers, and this is already happening. So sort of a transfer of wealth from the public realm, a huge transfer of wealth from the public realm into private hands. So you have this on the one hand. They issue this on September the 13th. It's already being adopted into law on several levels. And then they come up with another document that actually just came out yesterday, which is the Republican Study Committee's ideas of how to pay for all of these corporate subsidies that they have demanded. They say, look, we can't do this. We can't pay for so-called hurricane relief, and it has very little or nothing to do with the families that were affected by the hurricane. In fact, it's going to hurt those families. They say the only way we can afford this is if we make some radical cuts to the budget. So they issue another document, the RSC Budget Options for 2005, which says here's where we're going to make the cuts. And once again, you have this radical re-victimization of the very people who the money was intended for. And their demands are things like suspend Medicaid's prescription drug coverage. But more than that, you know, I mentioned the thing that really got me was I mentioned the fact that they're demanding subsidization for big oil for exploration that they won't pay for. But in this other document where they talk about how they're going to find the money for all of this corporate welfare, they say that they should cut all programs, all federal research programs, into sustainable energy sources. So here you have the issue that's really at the core of this disaster, which is global warming and fossil fuels, and they are subsidizing big oil and cutting funding to any alternative energy source research.
We're talking to Naomi Klein, award-winning journalist, author of the piece in This Nation magazine called Purging the Poor. And when we come back, she will be joined by Jeremy Scahill, Democracy Now! Correspondent. Blackwater Down is his piece. Stay with us. Erykah Badu, on and on here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we broadcast in over 375 stations around the country on Pacifica NPR and low-power FM stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, as well as both TV satellite networks on Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV 9410, Link TV, as well as on DirecTV Channel 375. And we are podcasting at democracynow.org. You can see the images of New Orleans there in video and in photograph, and we have headlines and Spanish audio transcript as well at our website. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest, Naomi Klein, award-winning journalist, author of Fences and Windows, as well as No Logo, and she's writing a new book that's coming out soon on disaster capitalism. In our studio, Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill. They've both written cover stories of The Nation magazine. Naomi's is Purging the Poor. Jeremy's is Blackwater Down. Jeremy, can you talk about the security scene that is enforcing what Naomi Klein has just described to us?
One of the things that I think is really important to point out is that the very forces that Naomi's talking about that are now trying to implement these sort of austerity measures in some ways, and then these sort of policies that target the poor, the forces that are implementing these policies are being backed up now by the very forces that we see operating in Iraq and Afghanistan. You have the U.S. military, of course, and the National Guard, and there's an enormous number. It seems like everyone with a badge and a gun is now descending on New Orleans. But you also have these private security companies like Blackwater, and we've talked extensively about the role of Blackwater in New Orleans here on Democracy Now!. And I think we have to view this in the context of what we've seen for decades in U.S. foreign policy, and that is the hidden hand of the free market and the corporate elite, and then the iron fist of military force. And so these measures are being backed up by these private security firms. One of the people who's brought in a private security company is a powerful businessman by the name of James Reese, and he lives in the wealthy, elite gated community of Audubon Place. They have the only privately owned street in the city of New Orleans. Well, he brought in a company called Instinctive Shooting International, which is an Israeli firm, and it's actually owned and operated by a guy who lives in New Jersey and has had contracts to train New York City police officers, but he's an Israeli martial arts expert. And this is part of a bigger trend of outsourcing the training of Homeland Security to Israeli firms. So he brought in these Israeli paramilitaries, one of whom bragged to me about having been involved with the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. And they're standing there in front of the Audubon Place community. And I went up and talked to them, and one of the guys said to me, we fight the Palestinians all day, every day of our lives. And then tapping on his M16, he says, most Americans, when they see this, they get scared, and it's enough to scare them away. But a lot of Americans, I think, would be shocked to know that there are Israeli paramilitaries patrolling the streets of a U.S. city. But what's more significant is who James Reese is, the man who brought them in. He serves in Mayor Ray Nagin's administration. He also runs a powerful business lobby, and Naomi has talked about him as well. He also was quoted openly in the Wall Street Journal saying that he doesn't want black people or poor people to return to New Orleans. So these kinds of sentiments are then being backed up by these military and paramilitary forces. Blackwater is also a very interesting case. They got a lucrative $400,000 contract from the federal government to provide security for FEMA reconstruction projects. The head of Blackwater, the founder, is a man named Eric Prince. He's a mega billionaire from Michigan. His father was a close friend of Gary Bauer. His father helped to found the Family Research Council. His sister, Betsy, is married to Dick DeVos, who is going to be the gubernatorial candidate of the Republican Party in the state of Michigan. Dick DeVos is the son of Richard DeVos, the founder of Amway, the greatest benefactor in the history of the Republican Party, the man who largely funded the Republican Revolution in 1994, this Christian fundamentalist corporation, Amway. And so he comes from a very powerful Michigan family. He's given hundreds of thousands of dollars to the Republican Party. He started this firm, Blackwater Security. He himself is a former Navy SEAL, and he staffs it with people that he describes as patriots, although it's interesting, they've been doing recruiting in Chile, hiring men who were trained under Augusto Pinochet's regime. And so these forces are now, there's about 200 of them in New Orleans right now, 164 of them on a no-bid federal contract with FEMA to provide protection for these sites. This is part of a bigger push by these paramilitary firms to gain contracts here in the United States. And for instance, Blackwater seized on the fact that four of their employees were killed in Fallujah in March of 2004. Eric Prince viewed this as a profit moment. And so what he did is he hired...
This is that horrible moment.
Horrible moment where you saw the charred bodies. They were hanged, and then it resulted in the massive U.S. onslaught against Fallujah that resulted in tens of thousands of people having to flee the city, scores of people being killed, innocent civilians, and of course now Fallujah has become an international symbol of resistance against the U.S. occupation in Iraq. Well, after these four Blackwater mercenaries were killed in Fallujah and then their bodies mutilated and hung from a bridge, Eric Prince hired the Alexander Group, which is a powerful Republican lobby firm tied to House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, and then hired a former CIA State Department official named Coffer Black to help promote their cause in Washington. In fact, just as the hurricane was hitting, another high-level person from the Pentagon was hired by the Prince Group, the parent company of Blackwater, Joseph Schmitz. He had just resigned as the Inspector General of the Pentagon, and he himself is involved with numerous scandals. So he's then brought on board, and then they get this contract. And what's interesting is that when I spoke to the Blackwater mercenaries in New Orleans, they said clearly, we're here on a Department of Homeland Security contract. That was denied by the Department of Homeland Security. One of them showed me a badge, said he'd been deputized by the governor of the state of Louisiana. That was then denied. Well, after this report came out, and it went all over the web, and we talked about it on Democracy Now!, the response was tremendous. And Blackwater was then under siege from reporters confronting them with this, and they were forced to admit, and so was the federal government, that in fact Blackwater was on a Department of Homeland Security contract, and that in fact they did operate with a letter from the governor of the state of Louisiana authorizing them to carry loaded weapons. And so they're patrolling in unmarked cars around the streets, and they said that they were confronting criminals and stopping looters.
Now, you actually interviewed some who claimed to have been involved in shootouts and to have actually shot people.
Right, and this is something that really underscores the danger of having these kinds of private security forces on the streets. I walked down to a hotel on the corner of Bourbon and Canal in the French Quarter called the Astor Crown Plaza. It's a 5-star hotel operated by one of the wealthiest business people in the state of Louisiana, a man named F. Patrick Quinn III. He's married to Republican State Senator Julie Quinn. They're a powerful Louisiana Republican family. He is the owner of the largest hotel chain in the state of Louisiana and is a powerhouse hotel owner in the South in general. And so I was talking to his head of security, a guy named Michael Montgomery, and he told me that he was with a company based in Alabama called Bodyguard and Tactical Security. And actually, Juan, when I was talking to him, I said that I was from New York, and he said, oh, I was in New York once. And I said, oh, yeah. And he said, I was there for the New York Daily News strike. And I naively thought somehow that he was an employee. He had been an employee of the Daily News. And I said, well, my colleague and friend Juan Gonzalez was one of the leaders of that strike. He goes, oh, I know Juan Gonzalez. I spiked his car. And I said, what do you mean? And he goes, well, I was working security there, and we spiked about 40 Daily News employees' cars at LaGuardia Airport. He said he put sugar in the gas tanks of the car. And so that was my introduction to this guy. And so we start talking, and then I asked him.
Solved the riddle of that big repair bill I had back in 1990.
What's interesting, Juan, is you could send it to the BATS company, Bodyguard and Tactical Security, except they don't exist. I talked to the Secretary of State offices in Alabama and Louisiana. There's no company called BATS registered. And they were wearing uniforms that said Bodyguard and Tactical Security. And so as I talked to him, this representative from the Phantom Company hired by a powerful Republican businessman, married to a Republican state senator, a major donor to the Republican Party and the Bush-Cheney campaign, operator of a 5-star hotel that is, he said, under consideration for a lucrative FEMA contract to house their workers. It's interesting because the hotel remains pretty much empty. There are no FEMA workers coming in there. But as I talked to this man who said that he had spiked your car, he told me a very scary story and that I think is the source for potential litigation against these private security firms. Michael Montgomery, the head of BATS, said that on the second night he was in New Orleans, he was going to pick up one of Mr. Quinn's associates. They got stopped in the Ninth Ward. He said they came under fire from a group of people on an overpass he described as black gangbangers. He said, at the time I was on the phone with my business partner, and I said, what did you do then? He said, I dropped the phone and opened fire. And I said, what kind of weapons? AR-15 assault rifles and Glock 9s. Fired up at the people he described as black gangbangers on this bridge. And I said, "What?" And then what happened? Did you kill them? He said, well, let's just put it this way. I heard a lot of moaning and screaming, and the shooting stopped. Enough said. Well, then he said that the Army came and responded to the incident, surrounded and thought we were the enemy. That's how he said it. He said, I then explained to the Army soldiers that we were security. They didn't care. They didn't file a report. They left. 5 minutes later, Louisiana State Troopers come. They ask what happened. He explains the story to them. They then ask him, how do we get out of the city? So this is the climate of impunity. This man, and as Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights points out, how do we know that he was fired upon? How do we know what that incident was? And why wouldn't
law enforcement file any kind of a report on a shootout in which this guy is openly bragging to having shot up a bunch of people he described as black gangbangers on an overpass. And so if I, as an investigative journalist, cannot track down this company, what if you were one of the people who was shot and wounded by this guy? What if you're the family member of someone who was killed by him and you can't even trace down this company? In fact, the Louisiana agency that governs and licenses private security firms, when I talked to them, they were furious, and they say that they're going to be serving papers on him today to cease and desist operating as a security officer in the state of Louisiana. And what's key is that he was hired by Patrick Quinn. Patrick Quinn is liable for the torts of his employees. So if this man, in fact, did shoot up a bunch of people, Patrick Quinn, this wealthy, powerful businessman, is also responsible for it. And what's interesting is that Patrick Quinn, bringing in an apparently unlicensed company to provide security, is that while you have shelters teeming with people desperate for work, Patrick Quinn is bringing in Mexican workers from Texas to clean out his hotel. And because of Davis-Bacon, they don't have to pay them, because of the wipeout of the Davis-Bacon Act, they don't have to pay them livable wages. So that's why they don't want to go in and hire, for instance, African-American men and women to come in and clean the hotel, because that gives them jobs that keeps them in that community. Instead, you bring in cheap labor from Texas, Mexicans piled on the back of a truck.
Soon after you did your piece, Jeremy, on Blackwater, when you first got down to New Orleans, and we posted it on the website, we started to get letters and email. There's an email, petition of Blackwater employees. Describe it.
The Blackwater employees and their families have initiated a petition against me. What's interesting is that they don't take issue with any of the facts that I've reported. They take issue with the fact that I quote one of the Blackwater employees complaining that he's only getting paid $350, because normally they make $1,000 more a day, right? And they say that they're just trying to provide for their families and put food on the table. These guys are making $1,000+ a day in Iraq and have all sorts of tax breaks. Well, now they're complaining of only getting $350 a day. And this letter, this petition, goes on to talk about how they're just like any computer programmer or any auto worker. And what's interesting is, I don't know about you, but I've never met an auto worker who makes $1,000 a day and shoots people in the face for a living. And that is what people like these guys do in Iraq. They shoot people in the face and maybe ask a question later.
Naomi Klein, can you describe how this security scene that Jeremy's describing on the streets of New Orleans fits into your assessment of purging the poor?
Amy, I think what it really underscores is the violence of the economic project itself. I mean, what we're talking about is a wrenching process of uprooting hundreds of thousands of people who are deeply rooted culturally, historically, economically in the city of New Orleans. And New Orleans is a city with a rich radical history, and people aren't going to accept this without a fight. And that's why the radical gentrifiers of New Orleans are arriving with their own private armies. I was talking about this with Jeremy yesterday, and it's almost like a kind of yuppie sci-fi version of old school colonial warfare. It's like the military industrial complex is been replaced by the mercenary condominium complex. Because what we're talking about here, the characters that Jeremy's describing, like Quinn and Reese, I mean, these are the key land developers in New Orleans, and they are the ones who are hiring these mercenaries to be the muscle behind the projects. So I think that's really the message. But there's something else at play. And, I mean, you hear these names like Blackwater, and then on the contracting side, the people who are getting the jobs to rebuild New Orleans are Bechtel, Halliburton, Fluor. These are the same companies that are in Iraq and Afghanistan. And they arrived very, very quickly. And the reason they arrived so quickly is because Reconstruction now is a standing multi-billion dollar industry, global industry, and whenever there is a war or a natural disaster, they move in instantly, often with pre-signed contracts. And, you know, we were all in New Orleans, and I think, you know, that city needs a lot of things. It needs pumps, and it needs affordable housing, it needs water, it needs electricity, but I didn't see any shortage of law enforcement. As Jeremy said, you know, everybody with a badge and a gun is there. So the presence of these privatized police forces, I think, is more ideological than it is anything else. And ideology is really driving the Reconstruction project. And if you listen to what's being said by groups like the Republican Study Committee, they're very clear about this. They talk in the language of experimentation. They talk, you know, Mike Pence says bringing free market ideas to the disaster zone is white hot right now. Treasury Secretary John Snow said, you know, this is a, he said this is a time where for all sorts of experiments. It's almost like they're putting on lab coats and seeing this area of massive humanitarian devastation as a place where they can vindicate their ideology. And their ideology, you know, was suffered a pretty serious blow by the disaster itself. I mean, there was talk in the first couple of days after the levees broke that this was going to be for neoconservatism what the fall of the Berlin Wall was for communism, that this was itself this incredibly graphic, damning event for the ideology of privatization. And Harry Belafonte the other night, you know, he had this great quote at the fundraiser organized by Wynton Marsalis, where he said this was the result of a political authority that subcontracts its responsibility to the private sector and abdicates responsibility altogether. But what, of course, what Jeremy's describing is a radical abdication, further abdication in response to the disaster. And what I saw when I was in New Orleans was really the emergence of an absolutely unmasked corporate military state. Now, I know these sound like buzzwords, but I'll just give you an example. One of the images that's really stuck in my mind was the conversion of a huge Walmart into a military base in downtown New Orleans. They call it Camp Walmart. So here you have, and we even hear people suggesting that maybe Walmart should replace FEMA as a disaster, running disaster response. Another example of this is there's a building in Baton Rouge, which is the Capitol Annex, which is attached to the state legislature. It's where a lot of the government offices are located. Well, after the flood, the Capitol Annex building was opened up to many of the business groups that we've been discussing. So now you have in that building a complete merger of government interests. You've got the mayor's office working out of that building. You've got the state legislature working out of that building. But you also have James Reese's Business Association. You also have Greater New Orleans, Inc., which is a private lobby group representing everyone from Shell and Chevron to Coca-Cola in that building. Then you have the Association Conventions and Tourism, which is another private business group in that building. And every morning, I was told this by the Assistant Secretary of Economic Development for Louisiana. He said, every morning there's an 8:30 meeting where 7 to 10 people from government and business sit down and plan the reconstruction of New Orleans. So it is literally the merger with completely unmasked of corporate and state interests as if there's no distinction. You know, they're not inviting the teachers union to be at these meetings. They're not inviting housing rights activists to be at these meetings. And you even see this in the repopulation plans for the city before.
Well, Naomi, if I can just interrupt because we have to cut this segment off, I'd like to ask Jeremy any final remarks.
Senator Barack Obama has questioned giving this money, this $400,000 contract to the Blackwater security firm. And I think that's a question that people need to be posing to their officials, because Congress could move swiftly to cut the welfare chain off for these private security firms. And it's something concrete that people can do right now as we look at the reconstruction of New Orleans, is to ensure that as people do try to come back and rebuild their communities, that they don't have to face down the very paramilitary thugs that are killing people in Iraq.
Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, thanks so much for being with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute.
What has happened down here is the wind has changed. The clouds rolled in from the north, and it started to rain. It rained real hard, and it rained for a real long time. There was 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline. The river rose all day, the river rose all night. Some people got lost in the flood, Some people got away all right. Where the river broke through, way down in Plaquemine, there was 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline.
Marcia Ball here on Democracy Now!, Louisiana, 1927. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're joined also by Prothap Chatterjee, managing editor of CorpWatch.org. His latest article, Big Easy, Iraqi Style, Contracts Flood New Orleans. In it, he writes, in Iraq, limited accountability, corruption, massive cost overruns, and devastating failures fed the chaotic mess that's followed the 2003 fall of Baghdad. Nonetheless, the largest Katrina contracts have been won by many of the same politically connected companies that oversaw that failed reconstruction. And it's perhaps no coincidence, since many of the same people in the Army Corps of Engineers are awarding them, and in much the same manner, as open-ended, no or hastily bid contracts with guaranteed profit margins. Prothap Chatterjee, take it from there.
Thank you, Amy. I want you to remember one name, and that is Carl Strzok. He's the commander of the chief engineer of the Army Corps of Engineers. He's the man who basically created the no-bid contract for Halliburton to repair the oil pipelines in Iraq. He presided over the meeting at which Bunny Greenhouse, the woman who actually basically blew the whistle on these no-bid illegal contracts, asked the Halliburton people who were sitting in the meeting to leave. He was then the man who demoted her and asked her, you know, now not to oversee these kinds of contracts. He was then sent to Iraq, where he oversaw all the Army Corps of contracts in Iraq. So he oversaw the multi-billion-dollar contracts that Halliburton had. This is the same man who is now in charge of the Corps of Engineers, and therefore the man who is now issuing no-bid contracts, so-called no-bid contracts, to Halliburton. They're not actually no-bid contracts. They're illegal contracts. And the reason is the Army Corps has no contract with Halliburton. The Navy does. These are contracts in Mississippi to fix the Navy facilities like the Stennis Space Center, and they borrowed a contract from their sister agency and used it to have Halliburton come in and assess the floodwater damage, something they're not supposed to do. So now Carl Strzok, the man who was in charge of the Iraq contracts, he is also the man, because he was in Iraq, who oversaw the fact that this money that should have been spent on the levees in New Orleans was diverted to Iraq. Part of the reason was his boss, Robert Flowers, who authorized all this stuff under the direction, of course, of the White House. The White House ultimately called the shots. The Army Corps of Engineers, if you go back in history, is the agency that basically straightened the Mississippi River and therefore led to these devastating floods. So now, come the 1990s, they've said, well, we need to rebuild, and correctly so. They need to fix the levee system. But when the Bush administration said to them, we need this money for Iraq, they gave them a palette of what they could spend and what they couldn't. And so they cut Army Corps of Engineers spending 44%. All the individuals who could have fixed the wetlands in Louisiana were helping fix the Iraq's southern marshes. And the man who was in charge, who was Carl Strzok's boss at the time, his name is Robert Flowers. He now has a new job with a company called HNTB. HNTB is based in Kansas City, Missouri. And what they do is they build levees.
Well, you know, the Republicans have tried to portray this as, well, you know, the situation with the levees and the problems in New Orleans have gone back for decades through Democratic and Republican administrations, and there was nothing that could have been done in the few short years between when Bush became president in 2001 and now to have been able to affect the situation. I mean, what's your investigation found out about that?
To a certain extent, that's true. I mean, this is a historical thing, but do remember the Army Corps of Engineers is the people who straightened the Mississippi River in the first place, built a system of levees, created the navigation system. So, I mean, you have to look over 80 years and go back to the floods in Louisiana in 1926, I think it was. So the problem wouldn't be there. There wouldn't be such devastating floods if they hadn't caused the problem in the first place. Could they have fixed it in the last 3 years? Probably not. So there I have to agree. However, they did, and both the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal has detailed the engineering problems in how the reconstruction of these levees was done. So where they could have built T-walls, the levees would have held, they could have built higher levees, they decided to spend less money because they were sending the money to Iraq. And so where it was $4,000 a foot, they basically built eye wall designs which broke at the 17th Street, Hammond Street, forget the exact name, intersection, the infamous 17th Street canal that broke. So they tried to cut costs. That's one of the problems.
Prothap, we only have a minute left. Summarize, again, the title of your piece at CorpWatch, Big Easy Iraqi-Style Contracts Flood New Orleans. What should people take away with this?
Of course, the Big Easy, you know, is New Orleans, and the exactly the same companies. Let me leave you with one thing. Fluor, the company that has a lot of the contracts that Halliburton lost in
Fluor
Iraq.
Fluor spelled.
F-L-U-O-R. They were doing a lot of the reconstruction contracts in Iraq. Their work is ground to a halt because of the strength of the resistance there. Their man, who was in charge in Iraq, flew from Baghdad to New Orleans to take charge of the contracts they now have in New Orleans.
Prothap Chatterjee, thank you very much for joining us, managing editor of CorpWatch.org.
Thank you, Amy.
It's good to have you here, as you're usually in Berkeley, California. Well, tomorrow starts the beginning of 3 days of massive anti-war activities in Washington, D.C. And so we'll go to D.C. right now to speak with Leslie Kagan about all of these upcoming events, coordinator of UFPJ, United for Peace and Justice. Welcome, Leslie.
Hi, everyone.
Can you talk about what the plans are for this weekend's mass rally?
Sure. Let me just say quickly, if anybody wasn't clear about why they needed to come to Washington this weekend, I hope they were listening to the last people that you just had on the show. All these connections are, you know, vitally urgent, and we need to make them on the streets of Washington. We are assembling tomorrow morning, Saturday, the 24th, on the Ellipse, sort of the backyard of the White House. Technically, it's actually the front yard. On the Ellipse at Constitution between 15th and 17th, at 11:30, a rally will begin. In addition to myself speaking at the rally, Reverend Jesse Jackson will be there. Cindy Sheehan will be there. Just a host of people from many, many communities, including Curtis Muhammad, one of the community leaders out of New Orleans, who is helping to fight the fight of the reconstruction fight in New Orleans from a community people orientation. He'll be speaking as well. Anyway, at 12:30, the march kicks off. We'll take a route that will go right in front of the White House on Pennsylvania Avenue. This will be the first time in some 10 or 12 years that people have been allowed to march literally on Pennsylvania Avenue in front of the White House. And then we'll circle around through downtown Washington. And then at the end of the day, there will be a massive concert on the Washington Monument grounds, a free concert that will go well into the evening. And through that concert, there will be additional speakers, including Jim Hightower, Julian Bond from the NAACP, military families, other Gold Star parents, Fernando Suarez, Medea Benjamin, a full program throughout the day. And throughout the whole weekend, we're organizing also on the Washington Monument grounds something we're calling a Peace and Justice Festival. And there will be tents set up, booths set up for people to get information about a host of issues, not only what's going on in Iraq, not only what's happening with military families and Iraq veterans and Gold Star families, but also making the connections to global warming, to the oil crisis, to nuclear issues, counter-recruitment issues, a whole range of issues that people can engage in. On Sunday afternoon, actually in the early evening, there will be an interfaith religious service. And then on Monday, we have two different actions on that same day. A lobby day. There are now close to 600 people already registered to lobby in the halls of Congress, and we expect several hundred more to join us. And hundreds of people would be participating in a nonviolent civil disobedience right at the White House risking arrest doing that. So we are calling on people, if you haven't made your plans yet, go to our website, www.unitedforpeace.org, and get the information. Washington, come to Washington. The country is at a crossroads. The nation is at a crossroads. Do we continue to feed our resources, our money, our young people into this war, a war that everyone knows never should have happened, a war based on lies, or do we redirect our resources and our priorities and start the rebuilding based on community needs with community input, community control, and dealing with the very problems that your previous speakers have just laid out for folks. Let me point out one other interesting thing about this weekend. The IMF and World Bank meetings, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank annual meetings happen to be in Washington this same weekend. So we'll be making that connection, too, between the military wars and the economic wars that are at the core of U.S. foreign policy. So we welcome everybody from all walks of life, from every corner of the country to join us.
Well, Leslie, you're a veteran of decades of anti-war mobilizations. What is your sense, including the huge one at the Republican National Convention last year, what is your sense of the mobilization and the response, given especially the enormous public sentiment that is turning now increasingly against the war in Iraq?
Yes. You know, even now, one day before the demonstration, it's impossible to say, you know, the exact numbers that have come. I think we're on the eve of a tremendous outpouring of people, hundreds of thousands of people from all walks of life. And I think you're right, the public opinion polls, that every new poll shows increasing numbers of people oppose this war, wanting the war to end. And that is our demand. End the war in Iraq. Bring our troops home now. But we're also making the connection to how this government has dealt with the crisis on the Gulf Coast. And it'll be interesting to see how they deal with a new crisis that might unfold tonight or tomorrow in another part of the Gulf Coast. So these are all connected. These issues are connected. And I think because of Hurricane Katrina, even more people understand just how, and it's not just that this government is incompetent, as some people have talked about it. It's the policies. It's the orientation. It's what the priorities are. And this has mobilized even more people to come to Washington. So I think we're on the verge of what may be one of, if not the largest, anti-war demonstration this country has ever seen.
Well, Leslie Kagan, we want to thank you for being with us. And in addition to this demonstration in Washington, we know there are protests all over the country. I was just in Birmingham and Huntsville, Alabama last weekend. They're making major preparations yesterday in Santa Fe and Albuquerque. So we know there are a lot of satellite protests as well as the one in Washington. Leslie Kagan, coordinator of United for Peace and Justice, and we will certainly be bringing the excerpts of the protests to folks next week on Democracy Now! As we wrap up right now, it is a very serious situation in the South with the Hurricane Rita about to hit the United States, one of the few radio stations that will be broadcasting, continuing to broadcast, is Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston. We are joined right now on the telephone by Renee Feltz, who is the news director at KPFT, and Dwayne Bradley, who is the general manager. While others are packing up and leaving, they're staying. Renee, tell us what's happening there.
Less than 24 hours before the hurricane is expected to make landfall, Houston is relatively quiet, but there are still a good number of people here. People should understand that the coastal areas are under mandatory evacuation, whereas the Harris County and Houston area are basically under voluntary evacuation. But there are still a lot of areas here that are flood-prone. People that live in homes and structures that could suffer heavy wind damage were expected to see tropical storm, perhaps even hurricane-level winds for 10 to 12 hours here in the Houston area. And what's concerning us here at KPFT in the news department is that the mayor has a contingency plan set up for shelters in the Houston area, but we really don't know what that plan is. Just had a press conference. He really didn't give any details. And part of why that's concerning is people, of course, have heard about this incredible traffic on the freeways, the major interstate serving as evacuation routes. Now, this traffic has been so bad that many people have run out of gas. Of course, that's a major problem. They may have to weather the storm on the freeways. They're opening up shelters along the side of the roads. But there's also a lot of people turning back and coming back to Houston. Again, they may not be in the best place to weather the storm, and so it becomes even more important to look at this issue of shelters. So we're hoping that partly we can pressure the mayor and urge other people to develop a sort of a mutual aid situation in their communities and their neighborhoods, to open up shelters, and perhaps KPFT can help to distribute information about where those shelters are.
And Dwayne Bradley, in 20 seconds or so we've got left, can you tell us how you're going to continue to operate the station?
We have a emergency generator in the backyard here, and we will run for as long as we possibly can if and when Houston proper loses power.
Well, anything we can do to help you, just let us know. Thanks so much for being with us, Renee
Thank you,
Feltz
Amy.
And
Thanks,
Dwayne
Juan.
Bradley of KPFT. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Dr. Ducci, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Ruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Maddie Harper. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. We'll all be in Washington this weekend. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.